Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Next hour, we'll take a look at why the FDA is moving to outlaw trans fats.
Now, though, we're delving behind the walls of the nation's most famous residence, the White House.
We're not talking politics, though. For the next half hour, we'll forget the polls and the partisanship and enjoy the history of the people, events, and objects of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, from inauguration bacchanals to Jackie Kennedy's redecorations.
Here with us to talk about that history is Bill Bishong. He's a historian, webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's also a contributor to the new book by National Geographic. It's called Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So what we know today as the White House is not the original executive mansion. When did today's structure come into existence?
Well, the cornerstone was laid in 1792, and John Adams was the first president to occupy the House in 1800. It was not complete at that point in time, as I think is famously known. There were only six rooms that were actually finished for inhabitable. And even the main staircase had not been built at that point. So it really was something of a roughing it for the Adams family when they first moved in.
And it got some future makeovers down the road, including the West Wing. Can you talk about some of the renovations that its residents down the road did?
Sure. Well, the major changes and reconstructions occurred Of course, after the 1814 fire, which reduced the White House to a blackened shell. It was reconstructed by its original architect, James Hoban, and then James Monroe moved back in when it was, again, not quite complete, but a lot better off than the Adams family were. And then again in 1902, Theodore Roosevelt remodeled the house extensively and basically just swept out all the Victorian decor on the interior and demolished all the old Victorian glass houses that were once situated on the on the west side of the house. Hmm. All of those were gone, and he built a small little office building out there called the Executive Office Annex at that point, but that little building would grow into and become the West Wing. It would be expanded in 1909 and again in 1934 to approximately the size that it is today.
So it wasn't as bad as the British burning it, but the White House took some hits in, I gather, Andrew Jackson's first inauguration. What happened?
Well, I mean, you know, that's one of those deals where there's a lot of exaggeration there too because of the political climate of the time. Jackson was a man of the people. He had won in a popular election and came into the White House. And his supporters obviously came to Washington en masse and came to the White House to greet and meet him and to congratulate him on his victory. And things got a little crazy in terms of the crowd and the size of the things that were going on. And people were, you know, very anxious to see him and greet him. And they were standing on the furniture in muddy boots and glasses were getting broken and all sorts of things were happening. And basically the crush of people was such that his staff got him and snuck him out the back door and took him back to the hotel. And then the stewards at the house started taking out large buckets of rum punch out into the south lawn and sort of trying to draw the crowd out so there wouldn't be so many people in the house. So it was a wild event, certainly. But partly its infamy really has come down through the time as well because of the politics of the whole thing.
Now, was that the wildest party that the White House ever hosted? They've gotten pretty sophisticated over the years. I can't exactly see people dancing on the tables anymore.
No, not in these days and times, of course. But we were still a pretty frontier nation at that time, and there was folks who came enjoyed a good party and kind of like a hoedown, I guess, in some respects. So they enjoyed themselves at the house, and I don't think that has ever changed as a tradition. I think there's been a lot of fun parties anyway. People enjoying themselves with both food and entertainment.
Was there a tension for a lot of years, maybe decades, between the idea of this is the big place in the United States, it needs to rival, you know, the palaces of Europe, versus no, this is a democracy, we don't have crowned heads, so we should have a more populist White House?
I think that's a really a cogent point, because over time that really has sort of shifted back and forth in our history. I mean, there have been times where people have complained bitterly about how shabby the White House looked and how much work it needed, and then there have been other times in our history where they said, "Oh my God, it's a palace! They're living like kings. They're, you know, spending tons of money on the place, and it should never be this way." It started really with a famous speech back in the 1840s known as the Gold Spoon Oration that talked about how Martin Van Buren was just living up the high life lavishly, and it actually had an effect on the election, and Van Buren would have, as you know, lost that election. So it was, it's as I say, you know, this sort of swinging back and forth with criticism or praise has changed really over the whole history of the White House. I think, we still have that sort of thing going on where even in the era of Mrs. Kennedy and her Kennedy and the Kennedy restoration of the White House, it was felt that some criticized it and felt it was she was just making it too fancy and in fact they would say off color remarks like she used a lot of ivory and white tones in the renovation of the house during the 60s, and so people would snidely say things like, oh, she's creating the off White House. Hmm. So things like that. I mean, you know, politics is politics, and people are going to criticize one way or the other.
You know, just to give a sense of, you know, the scope of the White House, a couple of numbers that jumped out at me. The White House can host a sit-down dinner for 140 people. It's bigger than my wedding, but I suppose it's still, you know, maybe not that huge a crowd. But also there are 35 bathrooms in the White House.
Yeah, it's remember you're, you know, if we're talking real estate, it's 55,000 square feet, six floors. So most of those floors, of course, are either public spaces or working maintenance spaces. There are two levels below ground for that purpose. You've got the ground floor, which incorporates both some rooms that are used for public uses like the library and the Vermeer room and others, and then there are others like rooms there for the curator's office and other things as well that are working rooms down there. Then you go up to the state level, state floor, which is really entirely public space. Then the third, and then the second floor, which is the private residence of the first family, and above that another story that is used by the first family, largely an area for some recreation as well as guest rooms. So you have a lot of spaces there, but when you really boil it down, there's only 16 bedroom guest rooms, and the president and the first family really lives in what is a large apartment rather than the entire house, because let's face it, you're not going to go down in your bathrobe into the east room for, you know, no matter what time of day it is. So in terms of a place to be comfortable and away and private, you really are restricted to the second and third floors.
So one of the things that's really changed over the years is the need for different and better security and modern technology. How has the White House, this old building, adapted to those changes?
Well, security, through the 19th century, except during times of war, the Civil War and the Spanish-American War, was really not what we even consider security today. It was just the grounds were open on a regular basis. People could walk into the residence, go up into the waiting area outside the president's office, and this time before 1902, the president actually worked in the house, you know, on the east end of the second floor. So the family was sharing office space and private space right up there up until 1902. So, World War I comes along, and we begin to see a tightening of security in and around the house. Of course, let's face it, assassinations had a big impact as well, with particularly McKinley's assassination, which eventually led to the Secret Service being detailed to the president. So these things continue on, and then, of course, World War II comes along, And that's when we see the beginnings of a perimeter defense really around the house with guard houses and sort of expanding outward to the gate, sort of security checks and the like. And then as time has passed, of course, now we're at a very careful screening before everyone comes in, metal detectors, et cetera, on into the house that way. So that's you know, just a quick overview of that whole history. But you said one other thing, and it slipped my mind.
Oh, the technology. I mean, there's lots of computers and things there now that weren't there in the 1840s, say.
Oh, of course not. Technology is, you know, obviously reflected. Its evolution is illustrated in the history of the house, everything from the beginnings of a flush toilet. Thomas Jefferson had Benjamin Henry Latrobe install two gravity-fed flush water closets in the house as early as 1803. So that was pretty, you know, out there in terms of modern. Running water came into the house in 1833. Hot water and an installed fixed bathtub was put into the family quarters in 1853. Gas lighting came in the 1840s, electric lighting in 1891. Then, of course, as time passed, you begin to have experiments with air conditioning. William Howard Taft famously tried to install ice bins in a system in the West Wing where they'd blow over fans over the ice to create cool air and try to cool off the offices. That never really worked very well. And then, but they eventually did, air conditioning really came into its own in the 1930s, and the house was air conditioned with window units at that point. And then during the Truman renovation between 1949 and 52, the entire systems of the house were completely modernized, plumbing, electric, heating, ventilation, et cetera, so to a modern standard.
We're talking now with William Bishong, historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's a contributor to the book Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents by National Geographic.
And do you have a question about the White House and how people live and work there? Is there something you always wanted to know but didn't know who to ask? Well, he's here with us now. Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 with your questions about the White House, or email talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with William Bishong, historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's a contributor to the book Inside the White House, Story from the World's Most Famous Residents by National Geographic. And let's go to our phone lines now. We have Ken first from Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
I'm doing okay.
I won't take up too much time because this is fascinating listening to the history, but I got to take a West Wing tour back in about 2006 during the Bush years, and I just wanted to comment on how unbelievably small it is inside the White House. I don't know if it's, or at least the West Wing, due to just the fact that there's so many rooms, so there has to be a lot of walls to, you know, separate the space. But it's just incredibly cramped when you go in there. You know, you think from movies and such that, you know, there's these wide hallways and, you know, there's lots of room to walk around. And it's not that way at all. But, you know, there's you know, little offices stuffed into every nook and cranny, you know, with a little tiny desk and a, you know, laptop that people work on. And it's just wild how incredibly cramped it is. And like the Brady Press Room, I think is the name of it, is just tiny. I mean, the amount of reporters that they must stuff in there. And, you know, I mean, there's seating kind of like a movie theater that the reporters sit in, and there's little, you know, plaques with the reporters' names and stuff for, you know, Cokie Roberts and other famous folks. But, I mean, the whole thing is, you know, not much bigger than, you know, a living room or two stuffed together. So that's really my only comment, is that it's really cramped.
Interesting. So what about that, William? He makes it sound like a bit of a rabbit's warren. Does it feel like that?
I think his name was Ken. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
I think, yeah, he's absolutely right. The West Wing has not been really, undergone another major expansion since the time of FDR. And so what has happened is that the spaces that were a little more airy, like there used to be a major waiting room in the West Wing during the FDR's time, and all of that area now has been broken up into these smaller offices that Ken described. And there are 450 people approximately working in the West Wing. So that's a lot of folks in a small area. Of course, proximity to power is the issue here, and people, the closer you are to the president, the closer and more prominent your role is in the executive branch usually. So it's a coveted space. It's really kind of funny if you look at the history of the executive offices. In the 1950s, they did a study, GSA, I guess it was, at that time, to look at the need for new offices. And one of the arguments made by a psychologist who was looking into this is that it would actually be bad for the mental health of the workers in the West Wing because of the tight spaces they were in.
All right. We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Margo with us in Waukesha. Margo, hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to know about the White House?
Well, this is funny because I watched White House Down with my husband last night, so I feel like the White House just keeps coming up. I am curious to know how much say the First Lady has in her family's diet, if the cooking and serving of meals for the private first family is just completely a service that's performed for them, or if the First Lady gets involved in that at all, if that's changed at all with Michelle Obama and her initiative with healthy eating.
Mm-hmm. I would, you know, the First Lady has a very big role in what in how the food is prepared, not only for her family, but also for the events that occur at the White House. So the executive chef at the White House confers with the First Lady quite often on the meals for the day and what kind of things that she would like to have prepared for that, what kind of menus that they would like to have. That sort of thing. So it's very much hands-on by the First Ladies, and her staff, of course, are also involved in all of this, particularly when a state dinner or something else of a larger scale is involved, and the White House Social Secretary is involved in that process as well, and there's a lot of there's a team of people working on it. But First Families, I think you could say generally, have always had a strong input in what kind of food that was served at the White House, and brought their personal cooks in the 19th century to the house to prepare their favorite family meals. And sometimes there were family retainers who came to the White House. Like, I don't know if you guys have a copy of the book there, but there's a beautiful picture of Dolly Johnson, who was one of the cooks who was brought to the White House in the 19th century. She was from Kentucky. And she was cooked there in the late 19th century, and just a marvelous portrait of her, that photograph. But that's just an example of where, you know, good home cooking was something that the presidents and their families loved, and that they brought their cooks with them over the years, and as well as, of course, accomplished chefs who would come in. Really, that's more of a modern type of arrangement. Really, again, the influence of Mrs. Kennedy was very important, bringing in René Verdun in the 1960s, and since that point on, we've had executive chefs at the White House.
So, William, I've taken it. You've been pretty intimate with the White House. You've probably seen areas of it that nobody else has, at least nobody listening here. And I wonder, when you're in it, does it feel like the history is right there, that it's palpable, that you could sense, you know, Abraham Lincoln walking the halls? I don't know if there are any ghost stories that go along with that, but what does it feel like in terms of history?
Oh, there's a lot of, as you probably know, a lot of ghost stories, particularly the most famous ghost of the White House is Abraham Lincoln. But beside the notion of that, the question you're asking is a very good one and interesting. It's like, it's clear that when you step in the White House, you feel the aura of the history, the tradition, and just what the building means as an icon and a symbol to us. I think for the people who see it for the first time, it is breathtaking in that regard. It's a beautiful, beautiful interior. The portraits of the presidents and first ladies that are hung on the walls, it's almost as though they're speaking to you as you walk through the halls. It just has an impact on you. And if you're ever there at night, I've only had this opportunity once, and it was just magic. The feeling when you go in the Red Room and it's lit by chandelier at night.
Wait, what is the Red Room?
The Red Room is one of the main parlors of the state floor of the White House. And it is, as I just described, it's red, beautiful satin on the walls, furnishings from beautiful decorative arts in terms of the furnishings there of the French Empire style, It is, you know, just exquisite, and it's just one of those kinds of things that just you know, is amazing. I'm in this room, and I'm in this place of history that, you know, a place that Abraham Lincoln and his family played cards and enjoyed time together, things like that. You begin, those sorts of thoughts start washing over you, and it really is remarkable.
Well, we can't let it hang there. Can you tell us a quick Abraham Lincoln ghost story of the White House?
Well, I'll tell you how it started. How's that grab you?
Sure.
Actually, in the 19th century, there was a gentleman who worked at the White House. His name was Jeremiah Smith, and he began working there during the Grant administration, actually, and stayed on for almost 50 years as in service at the White House. He started as a stable hand and then ended up at the end of his career as an old man. And he was basically, his only responsibility at that point was to keep the president's office dusted with a feather duster. He had this big feather duster, and he'd always stand with it out on the north portal, north side of the house. And so the press called him the Knight of the Feather Duster because of this regal pose that he would strike. Anyway, when it was a slow news day, reporters would get to talking to him. And so as he was known as Jerry Smith to most of the reporters who were friendly with him, he began telling them stories about ghosts that he had seen in the house. And of course, one of the ones was that he mentioned was, of course, Abraham Lincoln. And then he also added some embellishment to that and said he also saw U.S. Grant and William McKinley. And the funny thing about McKinley was, apparently, he said that this is Smith saying this, that he heard a buzzing noise whenever McKinley appeared, whatever that meant. I don't know. But there you have it.
Wow.
But anyway, that got translated into many news stories in the papers in the 19th century, starting in the late 1880s and building up into the 20th century. And, of course, that legend and that myth has continued on. And even the presidents and first ladies themselves have pulled pranks related to Lincoln's ghost in and around the Lincoln bedroom.
All right, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. Great stuff.
Okay, well, thank you.
That's Bill Bashong. He's historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's a contributor to the book Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents.
Next is the news, and then we'll be back to talk about a new move by the FDA to outlaw trans fats. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.